first caliph, they went to fight this person and his people. Their slogan was Ya Muhammad, Ya Muhammad. So they were calling, as these Wahhabis put it, a dead person.
Yeah.
Isn't it an act of polytheism? The Wahhabis say no. They are just, all of them, they are just people, they are virtuous. They didn't mean that. They didn't mean Muhammad as an independent person. So I think all these verses, narrations from Shia Sunni sources, all these events in the history tell us that these people need to review the way their perspective regarding the beliefs of the Shia.
And they need to contemplate on these duas, exactly. Actually.
Sure.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Dr. Karimi. You gave the beautiful explanations to clear these doubts, and they helped so much. And the best part of your answers I liked was that Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said that I was not sent down to judge your intentions. Mm-hmm. So when Prophet with that personality is saying that I'm not here to judge their intentions, then who are we as human beings, as common people, to judge the intentions that no Shias as the intention of Shias is this and the intention of Sunnis is this. The intentions cannot be judged by humans. That's proved in this hadith, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the best judge of the judges. He is the king of all intentions. He knows the intentions of all hearts, as we say, Wallahu A'lam, as he himself says, Wallahu A'lam. He knows what is in the hearts. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Stay tuned for more beautiful programs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Where is the rising sun?
Deported.
Part 2.
We join Yusuf's family as they go to visit Yusuf in prison, a 3-hour drive from their house in Tampa into the southern swamps of Florida. It has been almost 5 months since Yusuf has been imprisoned, awaiting his deportation hearing. It is now just 2 days away. Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, tries to remain hopeful.
We are so patient and we can wait. But this life of my son, they want to destroy him by putting him in a jail waiting for his winning after 1 week, 1 month, 1 year. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I'm going to advise him to be patient, to be in good condition in front of the judge, to let the judge know the truth about this case.
Yusuf's trial is held in the Chrome Jail in the swamps outside Miami. ICE has flown in a team of 4 lawyers to try the case. Yusuf's lawyer, Charles Cook, has agreed to take the case for free. No cameras are allowed inside.
We are currently in the second day of the trial. We just finished the testimony of the government's first witness, both his cross-examination and his direct examination. What's at stake is what young Muslim men in America can do and act like in America today. The reality here is, if you're a Muslim in America, you can't think like everybody else. You can't think like your colleagues. I have another client that we went to lunch with a few weeks ago who's about the same age as Yusuf. And I was telling him about Yusuf's case, and it was very interesting what he said. He had very little sympathy for Yusuf. He said, what is he thinking in America as a Muslim man? You can't go surfing on the internet, look at sites. You can't hang around with other people that are Muslims and talk about Islam. And I frankly find that sad.
David Cole is a law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an expert in constitutional and First Amendment rights. He says that the targeting of immigrants in America is nothing new.
Historically,
whenever the United States has faced a security threat, it has responded by targeting immigrants with its most restrictive measures. And I think that's partly because it's easy to do so. You know, it's one thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat. You've got to sacrifice some of your liberties and rights in order to protect the country. But it's another thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat, but we're going to give you more security by sacrificing somebody else's rights, namely foreign nationals, immigrants, people who have no voice in the political process. We did it in 1919 after a series of terrorist bombs. We went out and rounded up thousands of foreign nationals on pretextual charges, charges of guilt by association. Not one of them was ever found to have been involved in any of the bombings. During World War II, we rounded up thousands and thousands of Japanese immigrants. This kind of anti-immigrant targeting has been a constant feature in the United States at every point that we've had a security crisis. When you want to take action before somebody has actually done anything wrong, well, the criminal law doesn't really allow you to do that generally. Criminal law requires you to have some proof that an individual has either committed a terrorist act or has conspired to commit a terrorist act or has attempted to commit a terrorist act. It requires that you put the evidence on the table, that you give a person a fair trial. But if you use immigration law, you can find all sorts of pretextual charges to use against people. The government employs secret evidence often in immigration procedures. The same sort of fair trial rights don't necessarily apply. The Supreme Court has said that it's permissible to selectively single out people for immigration enforcement based on their affiliation with political groups. So the same sets of protections and rights don't exist, makes it easier to use the immigration process.
Dan Vara was the highest-ranking ICE attorney in the state of Florida from 2003 to 2006. He says that after the September 11th attacks, he began working closely with the FBI. His prosecutions became a model for using immigration courts as an arm of counterterrorism across the country.
2-3 days after 9/11, people like myself got the word from Washington that some of those obstacles that we had to doing some of the cases that we had been preparing for years were no longer there. And we were allowed to move forward and identify people for charges to be taken into detention and to be prosecuted, again, not criminally, but for the purpose of removing them from the United States. In Florida, once we began our work with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and even its precursor, just the FBI and other loosely associated groups, our involvement was day-to-day. We shared, at the height of my prosecution experience, FBI would feed me information every day.
Vara is proud of his work with the FBI and defends the tactic of seeking the deportation of residents against whom no criminal charges can be proven.
Many people get prosecuted and get acquitted, and they're guilty. When you sit at the table with other prosecutors from other branches of the U.S. government, and agents from all these agencies, and you're reviewing evidence, I mean, the goal is to find the way to deal with the threat. And if the only thing you have is tax fraud, if the only thing you have is an immigration violation, then, frankly, that's what you use. An immigration charge is administrative in nature. The burden of proof is less than they are in a criminal trial. So even though you got acquitted in a criminal trial, the reality is that the government could still meet its burden at clear and convincing evidence. There are so many people that put their fingers in every single terrorism case that I would tell you unequivocally that mistakes are not made.
In terms of identifying actual terrorists, the government has been very ineffective. So for example, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the government locked up, mostly using immigration powers, over 5,000 foreign nationals, almost all Arab and Muslim, in anti-terrorism preventive detention measures. Of those 5,000, not one stands convicted today of any kind of terrorist offense. So the government's record there is 0 for 5,000.
They don't have the evidence in these cases, and that's What they see as the beauty of immigration court is, heck, you don't need evidence. You just need a judge who's willing to look at all the garbage evidence and make a conclusory statement that I think you've met the burden of proof. Thank you very much. Have a nice life. Arguably, anything is the proper use of the immigration laws. Congress has designed it to be in many ways like the tax laws that cut Al Capone. Well, if we can't get him on the criminal charges where we have to meet this incredibly high burden of proof, we'll just deport somebody on an incredibly vague immigration statute. These immigration courts are part of the Department of Justice. They are an executive. This is not a judicial branch. This is not an independent judiciary. This judge was appointed by a previous attorney general. He works for the attorney general. These FBI agents work for, oddly enough, the same attorney general. The folks that are prosecuting this case at Homeland Security are also in the executive branch. The reality is you have the executive branch being both the prosecutor, judge, and jury in this case. We should all be concerned about that. We should be concerned that there is a complete lack of judicial independence here. Why would an immigration judge, whose boss is the one, presumably, that wants to prosecute and deport this man, say, "I'm sorry, boss, you're wrong"? Boy, it would take a judge with a great deal of courage to do that.
Many people focus on the Bush administration and particularly on 9/11 and the reaction to 9/11 and on, for example, the Patriot Act. But what you miss when you focus in that way is that this is a broader problem.
Now we're in the middle of the Obama administration. Attorney General Holder has approved this. Trust me, if he hadn't approved it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So clearly the Obama administration is continuing the same enforcement mentality that first Clinton and then the Bush administration followed in immigration.
There's involvement at the highest levels. The Secretary of Homeland Security, I would be very surprised if that person was not, Janet Napolitano, was not involved in this case. I would be very surprised that if that was the case. Not only because it's a terrorist case, but because of the publicity that it's getting.
A local Islamic group is speaking out about immigration officials' decision to detain Yusuf Megahed.
Having a fair trial and the jury finding not guilty, it seems like a slap in the
face. Their backup plan was to punish them in immigration.
Yusuf was arrested for one reason and one reason only, and that's because he looked Muslim.
With Yusuf's trial already underway, protests by community, religious, and civil rights groups continue to grow. In an unusual move, four of the jurors from his criminal trial, including foreman Gary Meringer, begin speaking out on Yusuf's behalf.
This just doesn't seem right.
There are things under the law that were put into effect after 9/11 that allows the government to simply say, "We think you're a terrorist, and therefore you will be detained until you have your day in court," and there's no judicial review of that determination. It's just a unilateral determination made by immigration officials.
We didn't know whether Yusuf should be deported or given full citizenship and allowed to finish engineering school. What we did know a lot about was the case we saw in federal court, and based on that case, he was not guilty of anything, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of the evidence, as might be required in immigration court, or by any measure that we saw, this kid there was no evidence that he had done anything wrong. It's like telling the government, if that's all you got, let him go.
I've been doing criminal defense work for 15 years, and I've never heard of jurors going to the media and saying how outraged they are about what the government is doing to somebody who they just stood in judgment of. It's amazing that they would do that. But I think it says something even more about the disconnect between our government policies and what the people who live in this country want.
If I do talk to somebody about this case, what positive can come about it for me? Not forget about Yusuf for a minute. Is there anything good that can happen? And the answer is no. But this is what I need to be doing. I would really like to think at the end of the day I did everything possible I could to get him a fair shake.
I was a history major. And during the pre-American Revolution, what jurors were doing and the verdicts that they were turning down and offenses that were being prosecuted by then the British government, was the same sort of thing. It was, we're not going to enforce these laws. These laws are wrong. What you're doing is wrong. And that's what these jurors are saying. What you're doing is wrong. You know, the law may allow you to do this, but it's wrong.
What do you think is going to happen at this trial?
Well, based on the evidence that I know of, it ought to be a very short finding of not guilty. But based on what I've heard about the immigration courts, the immigration judges, the influence of the government, the fact they can put on evidence and not even have to show it to the defense, what I think's going to happen is he's going to be found guilty as some sort of terrorist aider and abettor, whatever, and sent back. Yeah, it's funny, sent back, but sent to Egypt, where he hasn't lived since he was, I think, 11 years old.
At first, I was shocked because I knew the family very well, and I knew the Mujahid family. I knew their son. I knew how good he was, and I have a son. So I was scared. I told him, you know what, I'm not feeling, you know, comfortable for you. What if they did the same thing to you? So it made me feel unsafe. It made me feel scared for my kids. But I felt like I can't let the fear take over me. And I start thinking, right, you know, we have rights. We're American citizens. That we should fight this. It shouldn't take this route because this is wrong. And if we don't fight now, everybody else are scared, afraid, and they're going to hide away from it. So we thought we could fight it together. And I felt, you know, we can do it. If we as a community work together, we can do it. Give me a kind of, you know, strength to stand up and fight. And the more you learn about your rights, you have to stand up for your rights. We had a privilege to fight for our rights and speak our minds and have the freedom to practice our religion. Not because I'm wearing a headscarf that means I'm suspect. Not because I'm a Muslim, I'm a suspect. And maybe, you know, with all of us tonight, you know, are united as a community, Muslims, non-Muslims, everybody else, work together to solve this problem. No profiling whatsoever. We will be all safe, because that will be justice.
Yusuf Agat, his family, his mother and his father and his oldest brother naturalized, but they're having mixed feelings because their son is still being held by immigration authorities. So please make dua for the family. Keep tab on the case and support in any way you can.
When anyone in our community or even in a minority community sees this case, especially because this family is immigrants, they see themselves and they see what could happen to them. And I think they're concerned now more than ever, especially everything that's been happening in our community with this case or nationwide. But the main point here is that we have to be aware as Americans, all Americans.
1 week into the trial, just as the defense is about to present its case, the judge makes an unexpected announcement.
The immigration judge terminated removal proceedings. He did the right thing. When the judge walked into the courtroom today, and the first thing he said was, we're going to go over the exhibits in the case. I knew at that point we had won. Because otherwise, he never would have talked about the exhibits before I had presented a case. As soon as I realized that, I turned over to Yusef, and I said, I put my hand on his leg, and I said, you won. I don't think he understood me. He looked at me, and he didn't understand, and Dustin, my co-counsel, leaned in and said, you won the case. And then his big old grin, you should smile now, and a big old grin came on his face. He now understands what a great victory this is, for justice in America. The government presented a case today, and the last 4 days, it was junk. It was all about junk. And as a result, the judge finally realized what it was and dismissed it. This is the second time in my 20-year career that a judge has dismissed charges against somebody and terminated proceedings based upon the government's lack of evidence. So this is a very unique happening for me, and really for any immigration lawyer.
Outside the Chrome Jail, supporters and press wait until sundown for Yusuf's release.
I'm very happy for this. And I'm looking forward to go back to university.
I'm feeling so happy for return of my son to spend the Ramadan with us. It is the first night of Ramadan. We feel so happy by having my son to our house again. And I want to send a message for the government that this family of Mujahid, came to this country to live in peace and to work and take their degrees. Let us finish this thing. Please let us, Mujahid, the family, live here in peace.
I think it's all over now. I'm happy.
Yusuf is one of the very few who beat their charges in both criminal and immigration court. Despite no charges ever being filed against him, Rabia Haddad was deported to Lebanon in 2003. After being found innocent of all charges, Sami Hammoudi was held by ICE and then finally deported to Palestine. He now teaches political science at Birzeit University. They both say that the America that they left is nothing like the country they were once proud to call home.
When people ask me about living in the U.S., this is before September 11th, as compared to Lebanon or other parts of the world, I would always make the comment that everything else aside, it's still a country of law, where everybody is equal under the law.
I felt happy in the United States because I felt for the first time that I am free to think the way I want to think, to write the way I want to write, to go wherever I want to go. It's the opposite, 100%. I did not expect what happened after September 11th.
To this day, the government can walk into anybody's home, into any company, any firm in the U.S., freeze their accounts, confiscate all their documents on the basis of doubt. All they have to do is to say, we suspect you of terrorist activity.
In the United States, there is no justice. This is what I believe in, and this is what I teach my students. I don't believe that now inside the United States, anyone can say anything he wants. No. The American Muslims and Arabs are not exercising their full rights as other Americans. They cannot, because they will be punished. And the government has many ways to punish people if they want to. And one time, Ashcroft said, if someone spit in the street, we can try him. We can make laws to try him and put him in jail, if we want.
Civil liberties, human rights, the Bill of Rights are all things of the past. This whole matter of democracy and liberty and the rule of law, and it's just a myth now. It's just a myth. Any Muslim or any Arab living in the U.S. and hearing me say this will not think twice about it. They know it, they feel it, they're living it. But I hope that other U.S. citizens don't end up on the wrong side of the fence to find out how bad this USA Patriot Act really is.
The mentality that will harass the Muslims and Arabs, the institutions that will harass Muslims, will harass others.
Measures first introduced against immigrants inevitably get extended and applied to U.S. citizens. So over time, it's all of our rights that are at stake. So the first measures that that criminalized speech or that penalized political speech were targeted at immigrants, but ultimately became part of our criminal laws during World War I. The first measures that imposed essentially guilt by association were introduced in the immigration law in the early 1900s, but were extended to American citizens during the McCarthy era, and thousands of Americans were affected by that guilt by association. The first sort of ethnic-based targeting enforcement was against foreign nationals from countries whose ethnicity we didn't like. During World War II, that was extended, and we ended up locking up not just Japanese immigrants, but American citizens of Japanese descent. So whether it be, you know, racial discrimination or penalizing speech or guilt by association, the measures are introduced against immigrants initially, but eventually get extended to U.S. citizens.
It's created fear amongst the Muslim community, and a lot of people have become so concerned about stepping up to the plate and being an Americans. I mean, being American means that you have to stand up for your rights, that you speak your mind, you have freedom of worship, freedom of speech. Well, none of this has really flourished in our community after 9/11. Most people are scared to come up and speak their mind simply because they've seen what happens to those who spoke.
Controlling the community is controlling their minds, controlling their feelings. They will all the time be watchful, not to say things they like to say. They will say things that the government would like to hear. Not to do anything that they show that they are full citizens who exercise their full rights.
I think a lot of people are just very scared. Like, they wouldn't really talk about things, or they would try to, like, distance themselves. So I think it's more of just trying to get by, trying to live their lives, you know, go to school, get a job, like, just live a normal life and not really so much involvement outside of that.
Back in Tampa, the Mujahid family sit down to celebrate the beginning of Ramadan, their first meal together since Yusuf's second arrest.
I didn't imagine that we are going to sit together with Yusuf in the first day of Ramadan. Welcome back, Yusuf.
I'm relieved. I'm happy that I'm out of this immigration jail. I was kind of expecting it that I be released, but not on a specific date, because the government did not have a case. Like, they were just holding me up for the heck of it. The government is profiling people, they're targeting people just based on their background, not of any crimes they have done. In my case, they, of my Muslim background, they were trying to say I'm a terrorist, or that then I have to be deported on terrorism grounds. They just want you to sign requesting deportation and leave instead of staying and fighting your case.
We asked Yusuf what he will do now that he has won. Who does he want to be held accountable for his years in prison? Will he continue to speak out on behalf of others who are facing similar charges? His father, Samir, interrupts before Yusuf can answer.
Don't ask him many questions, because the government still now can make an appeal against him.
Do you think they will appeal, or do you think?
I don't know. They have the right to do anything.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Linda Geddes. The piece is titled "Centaurus: Virologists Express Concern at New COVID Subvariant." Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. The BA.2.75 variant, nicknamed Centaurus, was first detected in India in early May. Here, cases have since risen steeply and apparently faster than those of the extremely transmissible BA.5 variant, which is also present in India and is rapidly displacing the previously dominant BA.2 variant in many countries. BA.2.75 has also since been detected in about 10 other countries, including the United Kingdom, United States, Australia, Germany, and Canada. The European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, the ECDC, designated it a variant under monitoring on 7th of July, meaning there's some indication that it could be more transmissible or associated with more severe disease, but the evidence is weak or has not yet been assessed. The World Health Organization, WHO, is also closely monitoring the new variant, although its chief scientist, Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, said there weren't yet enough samples to assess its severity. In addition to its apparent rapid growth and wide geographical spread, virologists have been alerted by the sheer number of extra mutations BA.2.75 contains relative to BA.2, from which it is likely to have evolved. This could mean that it has had the chance to evolve an advantage over an already successful virus lineage, said Dr. Stephen Griffin, a virologist at the University of Leeds in England. It's not so much the exact mutations, more the number and combination, said Dr. Tom Peacock, a virologist at Imperial College London, who was the first to identify Omicron as a potential concern back in November of 2021. It's hard to predict the effect of that many mutations appearing together. It gives the virus a bit of a wildcard property where the sum of the parts could be worse than the parts individually. It is definitely a potential candidate for what comes after BA.5. Failing that, it's probably the sort of thing we'll have come along next. That is, a variant of a variant. Even if it doesn't take off in other countries, its growth in India suggests it is likely to be an issue there at the very least. Dr. Peacock added, "It's clearly growing pretty well in India, but India hasn't got much BA.5, and it's still very unclear how well it fares against that." Dr. Stephen Griffin cited it as yet another example of the virus's impressive capacity to tolerate changes in its spike protein, the part it uses to infect cells, and which most COVID vaccines are based on. This time last year, many were convinced that Delta variant represented an evolutionary pinnacle for the virus, but the emergence of the Omicron variant and the vast increases in variability and antibody evasiveness is a sign that we cannot, as a population, follow an influenza-like plan to keep pace with the viral evolution, said Dr. Griffin. In addition to vaccines, longer-term plans should include variant-agnostic measures to prevent infections and reinfections. This includes creating infection-resilient environments through improved ventilation, improved filtration or sterilization of indoor air, sensible reprovision of lateral flow tests, and appropriate and supported isolation periods that will actually reduce ongoing transmission, he said. Meanwhile, COVID cases have risen almost 20% in a week, with 1 in 25 people in England thought to have had the disease at the end of June, official figures suggest. As a leading statistician said, hospitalizations from the latest surge may be topping off. According to the latest data from the Office for National Statistics, based on swabs collected from randomly selected households, an estimated 2.7 million people in Britain had COVID in the week ending 29 or 30th of June, an 18% rise on the week before, when almost 2.3 million people had the virus. In England alone, the most recent figure suggests about 1 in 25 people had a COVID infection in the last week of June, with a figure 1 in 17 in Scotland. Further analysis revealed infection levels had risen across all regions of England and in all age groups. These increases are due to rises in infections with the Omicron subvariants BA.4 and BA.5, which have been dominant since mid-June, said Sarah Crofts, the head of the analytical outputs for the COVID-19 infection survey. Scotland continues to have the highest infection rate, although it has recently increased at a slower rate compared with other regions of Britain. The total number of people in hospital in England who have tested positive for COVID stood at 11,878 on Thursday, an increase of 33% from the week before. While an increase was also evident in the number of people in hospital primarily due to COVID, with 3,749 such patients in England alone as of 5th of July.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are going to talk about the family-related issues according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we are going to focus on some of the issues related to familiar problems or questions. And one of such questions is that I want to ask first at the beginning of this episode is that, you know, we know that when people become mature and young, they are under a lot of stress, sexually speaking, so they have different kinds of emotions, and especially with the advent of new technology, social media, satellite, and the like, and the kind of ties in the society which are very much, let's say, more provocative or provoking the young people toward, let's say, committing sins sometimes when they see, for example, let's say women, not like before, a question may, arise, and that is, some people ask that if they're allowed to whether masturbate in order to avoid, for example, fornication or zina. Is this justification reasonable and legally, let's say, jurisprudentially binding? In order to avoid, for example, adultery or fornication, allow masturbation?
A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I suppose our audience and those who listen to us are quite well aware of the fact that masturbation is absolutely forbidden, no matter what the justification. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make any difference whether a person is married or unmarried. Masturbation is absolutely prohibited, and it is prohibited under all circumstances. And people maybe may want to bring up excuses, or maybe may justify their actions. Mm-hmm. You know, masturbation remains forbidden, and no matter what the justification, you know, if someone wants to justify his action by saying, "Okay, I was, going to fall into a great sin like fornication or adultery or something like that, and so I did masturbate to avoid a greater sin." So this is not a proper justification. You cannot avert an evil by doing another evil, by doing a lesser evil. Mm-hmm. So it is necessary for every individual, in fact, to
stay away from haram.
To stay away from haram. And also there may be many people ask questions, they keep asking questions as to what they should do when it comes to, because of, as you rightly mentioned, there are, there is emotional stress, there are people with a strong sexual urge, and they don't know how to relieve themselves, for example, or how to concentrate themselves on, how to concentrate on their activities. For example, a student wants to study, okay, someone wants to do his job, and they do not remain focused because of their strong sexual urge, and that's why they are distracted. The religious authorities, generally speaking, they always say that it is necessary for a person to do regular exercise, because it does help to a large extent someone's, body, to stay balanced, or the sexual urge or desire to be under control. And if that does not help, then it's necessary for a person to observe fast, because someone who is fasting will not think of let's say masturbating, because he knows that masturbation is one of the invalidating agents. And the best of all solutions
is marriage.
Yes, if a person can afford to get married, of course he should take quick action to get married before he actually falls into the sin.
That's great.
So he should go and take action for marriage.
Okay, thank you very much, Ustavid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are talking about family-related issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei's verdicts with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a married man to ask his spouse to help him ejaculate? Because we talked about masturbation and self-satisfaction in the previous part before the break. So if somebody's married, not single, asking his wife actually to do the job for him, let's say, and perhaps in such a scenario, the wife may not be in the mood, for example, to do so, or in the mood for sexual intercourse. And then, the husband, on the other hand, wants to relieve himself.
Yeah.
So, if the wife doesn't want to do it, but does it out of marital duty, for example, so to speak, all right? Is it permissible in that case?
Well, that's also an interesting question, because just as you rightly mentioned, there may be, for example, someone, a woman, let's say, who is not in the mood to have physical intimacy. Mm-hmm. And so she, maybe also there are reasons for that. The weather might be very cold. If she, let's say, has sexual intercourse with her husband, then she has to, let's say, perform the ritual ablution mm-hmm. or ghusl. And that may not be possible for him, or maybe performing ghusl every now and then may be very difficult or cause her difficulty. So in that case, of course, it is permissible for her to help her husband, you know, reach orgasm or experience orgasm, or to help him ejaculate.
Yes.
And there is no objection to a woman doing it. Of course, we have different forms of, let's say, sexual conduct. Like, for example, they call it oral stimulation or oral sex, or let's say the different names are there. And these are as long these are possible and these are permissible as well,
yes.
as long as both the parties to the marriage are consenting to it, because it's not a duty of the wife to perform, you know, oral stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
But if she does consent to it, there's no objection there's no objection according to Islam, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah.
If she's not in the mood,
You know, if she's not in the mood, of course she can do it. You know, she can always help, but it's not, you know, she must in fact submit herself to her husband for sexual pleasure. That's her duty according to the Sharia law. And if she does not surrender herself to her husband for this purpose, she is considered to be rebellious, okay, mm-hmm. or disobedient, in which case she will not be entitled to maintenance.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your answering the questions. According to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas about family-related issues here in this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.